This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Yemen, as you know, is facing the largest food security emergency in the world. The humanitarian situation is really heartbreaking, with access to food, water, medicine and emergency supplies worsening by the 17 million people, which is the equivalent of 2 out of every 3 people, are suffering from severe food insecurity.
That's Etienne Peter Schmidt of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. Details coming up. Also, Nigeria marks 3 years since Boko Haram abducted 279 girls in Chibok. Many are still missing, and some parents say the government has failed them. And Egypt on high alert ahead of Easter Sunday as Coptic Christians mourn the victims of Palm Sunday's dual terror attacks. We'll have these stories and more for you, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We begin in Nigeria, where it's 3 days to the 3 years to the day Boko Haram came in the dead of night and took 276 girls from a school in the northeast town of Chibok. The mass abduction triggered a global outcry. Since then, some girls have either escaped or been freed through a series of negotiations between Boko Haram and the Nigerian government. But most of the kidnapped girls are still missing. President Muhammadu Buhari says he's working to secure their release, but some parents and activists say his government has failed them. This report from Chika Odua in Abuja.
Every evening, Enoch Mark reads from his big old Bible. His wife Martha sits beside him on a mattress on their bedroom floor. They say the words of the Bible have been a great source of comfort in the past 3 years since their 2 daughters were kidnapped by Boko Haram.
Time will tell. They will be free one day, one time. I'm still hopeful.
But he's also angry. To date, the Nigerian government has not found any of the 276 schoolgirls who were kidnapped. 57 of them escaped from Boko Haram. 3 of them were found by locals. With the help of the Red Cross and the Swiss government, the Nigerian government did recover 21 of the girls last year. But Mark says that's not enough. He says Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has failed.
If Buhari will be sincere with himself, why can't he not put this insurgency under control? How many girls have his government rescued among the Chibok girls? If he will tell himself the truth, is he really, he mean business to be as a president of Nigeria?
That's the voice of Aisha Yesufu, one of the leaders of the Bring Back Our Girls group in the Nigerian capital, Abuja. They met earlier this week to remind the public that the girls are still missing. They've kept the campaign going. The group has gotten smaller as the years have gone by. But members like Obi Ezekwesili can still excite a crowd.
Our government made a commitment that our Chibok girls would be brought back. We are holding our government accountable to its commitment. Our government, even before it went into power, said that it would swiftly bring back our girls.
It's been a difficult 3 years for the parents of the missing schoolgirls. After the mass abduction of the schoolgirls, Boko Haram attacked Chibok again a couple of times. 19 parents of Chibok girls have died, having never gotten to see their daughters again. Martha, Enoch's wife, has joined the women's choir at her local church. She says participating in church activities has helped her survive the years without her 2 daughters. But some days are more difficult than others. She's trying to manage her emotional distress, but it's taking a toll on her.
Detain Penny. I have things worry me. I have hypertension and some ulcer and other sickness for my body. So the thing is paining me. Seriously.
The Mark family is doing the best they can to continue with life. Enoch had a massive stroke last year. Martha is not sure if she will ever see her daughters again. 12-year-old Hanatu is worried that she may forget what her sisters look like. 16-year-old Ruth is still suffering from a hip injury from when she ran away from Boko Haram the night her sisters were kidnapped. The family heard the announcement this week that the Nigerian government is negotiating to recover the rest of the Chibok girls. But they've heard this before.
For the earth shook yesterday with the sounds of men wailing in agony.
Across town at another Bring Back Our Girls event held this week, a poet recites a poem for the Chibok girls and all the other Boko Haram abductees who are still missing. Chika Odua in Abuja for VOA News.
The United Nations says Yemen is home to the world's largest humanitarian crisis, with more than 17 million people facing food insecurity. It's one of the countries facing famine, along with South Sudan, Somalia, and Northeast Nigeria. The UN says despite the size of the crisis, it does not receive as much media attention as the other countries. VOA's Joe DiCapua has more.
The risk of famine in Yemen is not the result of drought. There was enough rain. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization blames much of it on the two-year-old conflict between forces allied with the government and those supporting the Houthi rebels. But there are other factors as well. Little land is available for farming, fishing has declined, and herders have sold much of their livestock to raise money. Etienne Peterschmidt is the deputy FAO representative for Yemen and in charge of emergency operations.
Yemen, as you know, is facing the largest food security emergency in the world. The humanitarian situation is really heartbreaking, with access to food, water, medicine, and emergency supplies worsening by the 17 million people, which is the equivalent of 2 out of every 3 people, are suffering from food insecurity.
Of that 17 million, 7 million are classified as severely food insecure.
The situation is really unprecedented. We have never had so many people in one country facing starvation. Really, if we fail to act swiftly in a concerted effort, famine is a possibility and likely scenario for 2017.
Even before the conflict, Yemen was one of the poorest countries in the region and already faced a lack of food. In 2012, between 10 and 12 million people were considered food insecure. There was a sharp increase once the fighting began. Peterschmidt says access by UN and other agencies to those in need is difficult, but doable.
We have managed to access a wide number of governors. There are pockets where we don't access because of the conflict, but also because some of these communities are really remote. In general, it is complicated. We have managed to stay. We have managed to deliver. The volume of our deliveries, the number of people that we have managed to support, actually increased in 2016 and is likely to increase in 2017.
The FAO official says the coastal areas of Yemen have some of the highest proportions of food insecure people. A more than $2 billion humanitarian appeal for Yemen has been issued for this year, second in amount only to Syria.
The $2.1 billion that the UN and its partners are asking is obviously far below the real needs, whereby we looked at defining the absolute priority of the priorities, and we also considered factors such as security, such as our capacity to access all the areas. It's what we feel we can do and where we can still have a substantial impact. The needs of the population are obviously far greater than that.
Last year, humanitarian agencies requested $1.8 billion for Yemen. Peterschmidt says just over 50% of that was received. Yemen imports up to 95% of the cereals it consumes. Peter Schmidt calls that a huge amount that must be reduced. Only 4% of Yemen is arable land, and just a small percentage of that is designated for cereal production. One of Yemen's planting seasons is underway, but Peter Schmidt says it's too late to provide much support for it. Another planting season arrives later in the year. The FAO is also working to increase fishing and to restock and vaccinate livestock. Herders often sell their sheep and goats after being displaced by conflict. Even with the conflict, Yemen has been a destination for many people fleeing the Horn of Africa due to humanitarian crises there or to seek better livelihoods. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In the United States, members of the South Sudanese diaspora have heard harrowing accounts of how friends and families are being killed at home. As VOA's Ayen Biyor reports, the South Sudanese community in America says enough is enough. It's urging the United States to act immediately.
When South Sudan is making headlines here in the U.S., it's usually not good news. Simon Deng, a South Sudan activist from the northeastern state of New York, says he was horrified to hear about the killings in Wau and Pajuk this week. Deng says the problem in South Sudan is President Salva Kiir, whom he accuses of dividing the country along ethnic lines.
Enough is enough for Salva Kiir. We have seen enough. We have seen death. We have seen women being slaughtered. We have seen kids being slaughtered. We have seen people being beheaded. We have seen the demonization of the minority in the hands of the majority.
Teresa Samuel Boko, a member of the umbrella activist group Global Partnership for Peace in South Sudan, says imposing a UN-backed arms embargo could be a major step toward curbing the country's violence. And she says the UN should follow through on its plans to bolster UN mission in South Sudan forces.
And what we have been as a community advocating for it is the deployment of UN troops in other states rather than the troops being concentrated in Juba, which creates more vulnerability in the other states around South Sudan.
Peter Quell, who lives in the northwestern part of the U.S. in Washington state, also blames President Salva Kiir for atrocities that eyewitnesses say are being committed by government soldiers. Quell says he has lost confidence in the president's ability to unite South Sudanese and believes top political leaders use tactics to divide his people.
You should protect all the citizens, young and old, women, and anybody. But protecting a particular group of people is not helping our people. With the man from President Trump and the all international community, including IGAD, to remove Salva Kiir, to have a peace. We stop the displacement of millions of people. We stop the payment. We stop the suffering of many South Sudanese.
In a press statement released this week, GAP says the international community shares in the blame for the continued violence in South Sudan. Top UN officials have warned of ethnic cleansing in South Sudan and have declared fears of Rwanda-like genocide looming in the country, while blaming both government and rebel forces for committing violence. This week, Priti Patel, Britain's Secretary for International Development, called the crisis in South Sudan a genocide. The government denies its soldiers are targeting civilians. But for diaspora members like Dr. George Imuro in the southern state of Texas, the international community has fallen short on its promise to avoid a repeat of mass killings like those that occurred in Rwanda.
We have beaten our tanks for the last 4 years. The world has failed us. The world say genocide is going to happen. I say genocide is happening. The world say ethnic cleansing occurred from day one.
Samuel Boko says she is disappointed that her country runs the risk of taking a back seat to other major atrocities around the world.
I understand there had been lots of chaos around the world with everything that's going in the Middle East and so on. But we are afraid as a community that South Sudan is, and the genocide that's going in South Sudan is reaching to a boiling point.
Boko says if things don't change, she fears major issues will erupt and the entire country will be out of control. In a statement released today, Daniel Bekele, Senior Director for Africa Advocacy at the Human Rights Watch, says the pattern of abuses by government forces against civilians in WOW has become predictable, with soldiers taking revenge against unarmed civilians based on their ethnicity. Bekele says South Sudan authorities need to stop the killings, investigate the attacks, arrest the perpetrators, and bring justice to victims of crimes. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
In Senegal, nearly two dozen people are dead after a fire at a Muslim retreat near the town of Medina Gounas. Firefighters say the blaze swept through makeshift straw shelters, triggering a stampede. According to the French press agency, one witness said only modern tents used by religious leaders withstood the fire. About 20 people are now reported to be seriously injured. They're being treated in Tambacounda city. That's about 80 kilometers from the site. Senegalese President Macky Sall was expected to visit the site today. Senegal's Quotidien newspaper says six people died in a similar incident at the same site 7 years ago. Egypt has stepped up security ahead of Easter Sunday, but some churches in the country have cancelled celebrations to mourn the 45 people killed in last weekend's twin terror attacks. As Coptic Christians there try to come to terms with Palm Sunday's church bombings, many blame the Egyptian government for not doing enough to protect them. Nuria Tesson is in Cairo for us with this report.
Coptic Christians have been targets for Islamists in Egypt. And that's not a new thing, as sectarianism has been rising in the last years. What is new is that the Copts are starting to blame President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's government for doing nothing about it. Government officials were not available to comment on the allegation. Mina Thabet is a human rights researcher who focuses on minorities and vulnerable groups in Egypt.
They voted for Sisi because they were afraid of what would happen to them if Morsi continued. Now they started to realize that it's not about who is ruling, it's about how he's ruling. Maybe Morsi was the worst, but Sisi is not the best man. He's not doing a very good job in fighting terrorism or in fighting extremism. I just want to control, not to give freedom for religion. What the government should have done is to fulfill its duty to respect and protect the right of freedom for religion and to stop discrimination and to fight discrimination.
He says that to fight terrorism, you have to both educate people to avoid sectarianism and to end the repression of the government against the citizens that push people to radicalize. Thabet, one of the 60,000 political prisoners jailed under Sisi's rule, says oppression only leads to more radicalization. The government is under a three-month state of emergency following Sunday's bombings. But for many like Thabet, this is not the solution to the problem.
It's a comprehensive strategy. That's what we need. Eliminate the real causes of terrorism. And they eliminate the environment that helped this tourism or this phenomenon to go and to continue and to grow. When you push people to extreme poverty, so you push people into the corner. And when the people get desperate, they can do anything. So they can be a pride for such extreme groups. Extreme security measures is not helping, and oppression is not helping.
He says the Egyptian government is sending the wrong message to terrorists. The Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights has documented at least 64 sectarian incidents between 2011 and 2016 where the authorities resorted to reconciliation instead of applying the law. As a result, there has been no punishment of the perpetrators of violence against Coptic Christians. For Voice of America, this is Nuria Tesson from Cairo.
It's 24 past the hour. You're with Africa News Tonight. Debate is heating up in Italy over what to do about the migrant crisis. This follows Thursday's boat tragedy off the coast of Libya, in which about 100 migrants are feared dead. More than 20 others were rescued. Reporter Josephine McKenna is monitoring the political comments about the migrant flow to Italy. She's in Rome and spoke to VOA's Joe Di Capua.
Well, the fact that this tragedy has just occurred so close to Easter, there is a reaction in Italy, and particularly from the Catholic Church. one of the Catholic charities that supports migrants, Fondazione Migrantes. The head of that organization, Monsignor Giancarlo Perego, has spoken out about this latest tragedy, saying it's a failure of the agreement that has so recently been reached between Italy and Libya. As we know, Italy wants to stop the flow of migrants, stop the people smugglers who are sending people across the Mediterranean in very dangerous conditions. And this fellow, Monsignor Perego, says this tragedy is an indication of a complete failure of that agreement. And he said he's also quite disgusted that while Italy and Europe are speaking always about security, women and children in particular have been completely forgotten and abandoned. And he said a mountain of dead bodies seemed to be rising up through the Mediterranean because not enough was being done to save people being affected by these tragedies.
Now, we're also hearing criticism today from the opposite side of the issue, the anti-immigrant organization.
That's right. Matteo Salvini, who heads the Anti-Immigrant Northern League, which has close relationships with the National Front in France and is a supporter of Donald Trump's immigration policies. Matteo Salvini made a very strong comment saying after the umpteenth tragedy in the Mediterranean, politicians in Italy should have on their conscience the 600 people who are believed to have died since the beginning of 2017. And he takes a very hard line. His party is against the intervention to save people's lives. He criticises NGOs and people, he says, are pretending to be refugees. He doesn't think that they're genuine refugees. And he thinks that Italy has accepted far too many and can't cope with the flow of migrants that we're seeing here.
How much of this debate in Italy is affecting the political leadership in the country?
Well, the Italian government just this week has passed new laws that will set up new centres that are going to process applications for asylum much more quickly. And we're seeing a much harder line on repatriation. It looks like the government is reacting to that political concern by putting in measures that are going to be much more severe if they are enacted.
And that's reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome speaking there to VOA's Joe DiCapua. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, you're welcome to visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please do stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Curtis Beinel, thank you for choosing The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Hey there, this is Shauna Renee, the lady DJ and host of Soul Lounge. every Sunday at 1400 UTC. I choose an artist that you and I love, and we break down their entire career while listening to their biggest hits. That's what we do here on the Soul Lounge. Once again, every Sunday, 1400 UTC, right here.